Welcome to the Republican Professor. I'm your host, Dr. Lucas J. Mather. I'm also my own host today. Today is 10 April, 2026 years after Jesus. It's a Friday. We're back in the history of political philosophy, Aristotle. First name Ari, last name Stottle. Mr. Stottle, come to the front desk, please. Mr. Ari Stottle, come to the front desk. This selection was written by my mentor's mentor, Harry V. Jaffa. He's a grandfather of mine, as I just said, in terms of mentoring. He mentored Michael Uhlman, who in turn mentored me for over a decade. And we stopped at page 89 last time in this wonderful volume, History of Political Philosophy. Quite a catchy title, huh? Published by Rand McNally in 1963, edited by Joseph Cropsey and Leonard Strauss. And the Aristotle selection here is written by the same guy that wrote for Republican presidential candidate 1964, Barry Goldwater, the famous quote that extremism in defense of liberty is no vice, moderation in pursuit of justice is no virtue. And I mean, it's a line that's famous. It's an Aristotelian line. The year before this was published, and it's on Aristotle. So there is a link. It's not just classical philosophy, it's not just classical political philosophy. It's got significance for electoral politics at the national level. And so we're dipping in, man. And on page 89, we're going to do fair use of this, make transformative reading. We'd like to thank Harry Jaffa for writing, and we'd like to thank Rand McNally for making it available. Later editions were published by the University of Chicago Press, and they don't have this selection in those later editions. We'd like to thank Leonard Strauss and Joseph Cropsey, who are now deceased, as is Harry Jaffa, and Aristotle's deceased too, FYI. For editing this, and thank you, Ari, for writing it too. I mean, it's been a few thousand years, couple thousand years, couple 3,000 years. But it's been about 2,400 years or so. So we thank you, Ari. Appreciate it. 2,300 years. We're gonna go ahead and get going here. Page 89. We're gonna go as long as it's profitable for us. Now, the last episode was on 31 Jan 2026, from page 80 to page 89. That was part four. This is part five in the TRP world here. Part five, and today is 10 April. 2026 years after Jesus. Oops. Man, I keep breaking this lead. I don't know what it is. Number five, buddy. Okay, guys, let's get going. After the discussion of the three regimes of speech or theory, we come to the three actual regimes which exist indeed. Concerning any regime, Aristotle says, there are two questions. First, how does it compare with the best regime? Second, is there anything in its construction contrary to its hypothesis? The meaning of the second question becomes clearer from an explanation at the beginning of the fourth book of the different kinds and degrees of political excellence with which the political philosopher must be concerned. The best regime is such as one ought to choose if there were no external impediments, either human or non-human. to virtue or virtuous activity as the end of life in the polis. The hypothesis of the best regime is just this, that virtue is its end, and that there are no external impediments to its attainment. In practice, however, there almost always will be impediments both to the choice of the best end and of the best means. The hypothesis of a regime other than the best is the assumption or set of assumptions by which the controlling aim or purpose of the regime is qualified in the light of its impediments as compared with the best regime. How are we doing so far? You liking Harry's prose here? The analysis of Sparta reveals above all one thing, the inner connection between the quality of the construction of a regime and the quality of its hypothesis. Sparta is a def is defective not merely because conditions are less than perfect, but because the legislator mistook a part of virtue for the whole of virtue, and this intellectual error is the leading cause of the defects Aristotle discovers. Aristotle's critique of the legislator's purpose comes almost at the end of the discussion of Sparta, but as so often happens, the end is in fact the beginning. The entire ordering of the laws is directed to a part of virtue, the part which contributes to success in war. The Spartans' warrior discipline won them safety in war and an empire, but they had no training in the pursuits of peace and began to go to pieces as soon as they had won their hegemony. They err also in another respect, according to Aristotle. And this error is really at the bottom of the other. They rightly think that the good things won by fighting are the achievements of virtue rather than vice. They wrongly suppose that the external rewards of virtue are worth more than virtue. The full meaning, page 90 at the top, History of Political Philosophy, edited by Joseph Cropsey and Leonard Strauss, published by Rand McNally in 1963, the selection on Aristotle by Harry V. Jaffa. Going from page 89 to 90, clunkiest page turn ever. The full meaning of this observation is given in Book 7 in the famous discussion of the relative merits of the active and contemplative life as the ultimate goal. Let me start that one over. It's given in Book 7 in the famous discussion of the relative merits of the active and contemplative life as the ultimate goal, either for a single man or for a polis. Sparta is there too given as an example of a polis devoted wholly to war. And war is there seen as the goal of life of those who do not grasp the ultimate supremacy of thinking over acting as the basis not only of thought but of action. The criticism of Sparta has three main divisions. The last part centers upon the principle or hypothesis of the regime. The first concerns the defects of Spartan economy, slaves, women, property. The second concerns political defects in the narrower sense, the ephors, elders, and kings. We will limit ourselves to the first and last and their connection. Aristotle begins his criticism of Sparta by observing that a well-governed polis needs leisure, and this can only be provided by slaves. He says little more on the subject here, other than that the Helots are like an enemy in the Spartans' midst, awaiting only for the disaster to strike their masters to rise and revolt. Aristotle does not say here what the remedy for such a situation must be, but the answer has already been made clear. The art of ruling slaves is a part of the household. The art of ruling slaves is a part of household management. And the Spartans have not cultivated this art. The reason, too, is clear. Household management is an art of peaceful living, and friendship between master and slave, to the extent it is possible, depends upon a common purpose uniting them in such a way that both contribute to it according to their natures. Okay, so if you're not familiar with Aristotle's book Politics and his discussion of the household, his discussion of these different regimes, here we're talking about Sparta, he's talking about Sparta, you may not be familiar with just how close Harry is tracking Aristotle here. He's track, yes, he is interpreting some things, but there's some analysis, but he's tracking it very closely as he goes through here, what Aristotle is saying about Sparta and linking it to what he said already about household management in Politics. So this is a very good flavor of Aristotle. Very good flavor. And now let me speak a little bit about method here. Method in teaching political philosophy. Whether it's classical, whether it's medieval, whether it's Renaissance, modern, contemporary, what have you. I would say the closer that you get to the present moment, in terms of language and custom and culture and all that stuff of the philosopher relative to you, the reader, you can take this with less of a grain of salt, what I'm about to say. But I would say that when you're beginning and you're encountering these foreign and ancient voices for the first time, you can dive right into the primary texts. That's true. Yeah, you can. That's one way to do it. But there is a question for teachers about what really does a better job, assuming you have decent students, which is a big assumption. It's probably a bad assumption. And so, what I want to say here is simply this, that when you encounter a voice like Aristotle, who has been studied so closely for so long and has had such a huge impact on philosophy and civilization, it's not a bad idea to have a guide that you interact with first before you get to Aristotle. It's not a bad idea. I'm not saying I think that that's the best thing for every situation, but I've tried both, and it's not a bad idea to read about Aristotle first so that you have some, you're prepared in a way to encounter what you're about to encounter, because it's going to be very strange either way. Okay. I just wanted to say that there. The reason is clear. Household management is an art of peaceful living. Harry Jaffa continues about Aristotle on Sparta. And friendship between master and slave, to the extent it is possible, depends on upon a common purpose uniting them in such a way that both contribute to it according to their natures. War, or success in war, as an end in itself, means ruling those who are not meant to be ruled, and for such a purpose for which men are not meant to be ruled. That's an interesting sentence there. War, or success in war, as an end in itself, means ruling those who are not meant to be ruled, and for a purpose for which men are not meant to be ruled. The Spartans' defective relation to foreign poleis, that's plural, in virtue of their policy of conquest, is reflected in their defective internal relation with their slaves and wives. In cruder terms, in their anxiety to rule those abroad whom they ought not rule, they neglect those at home whom they ought to rule. The same reasoning accounts for the licentiousness of Spartan women, who, by reason of the neglect of the men, preoccupied with military pursuits, and because of the addiction of soldiers to pleasures of love, are self-indulgent and unmanageable. The women tend to get control of the management of affairs as well. What difference does it make, asks Aristotle, whether the women rule or the rulers are ruled by women? The result is the same. The irony of all this is that the polis that identifies the whole of virtue with the supposedly most manly of virtues, courage or fighting, is penalized by being dominated by females. The irony comes full circle when Aristotle points out that, in neglecting to rule their women properly along with their slaves, both because of their absences on the military expeditions and because they had neglected the domestic arts while at home, the Spartans greatly weakened themselves militarily. That's insightful. That's very insightful. For during the Theban invasion, the women of Sparta caused more confusion than the enemy. Oh man. Ugh. Aristotle's just really blunt. The subordination of the pursuits of war to those of peace is then a necessary condition of a truly successful military policy. I'm going to read that again. The subordination of the pursuits of war to those of peace is then a necessary condition of a truly successful military policy. The defects of the system of property are consequences of the condition of women. It is dishonorable in Sparta to sell a family estate, but not to give it or bequeath it. The result is that nearly two-fifths of the land is owned by women. Without regulation of inheritances, and with the practice of large dowries, the ban upon alienation of estates has proved inconsequential. As a result of the concentration of ownership, there has been a depopulation of the armed class who need property to furnish the wealth needed for arms, as well as a social division into extremes of wealthy and of poor. Again, we see the attrition of the regime's military strength as an ultimate consequence of its military nature. That's very interesting. Page 91. The discussion of Crete. Okay, so that was Sparta. Now we're going to Crete. And again, Harry Jaffa is simply tracking what Aristotle is saying. Okay. The discussion of Crete, which follows that of Sparta, also has three main parts. First, an account of the relationship of Crete and Sparta. Second, an account of analogies in the two systems. And third, and evaluation of similarities and differences. Sparta is held to be an improved imitation on the whole of Crete, which is the older regime. This raises some subtle and interesting questions as to the possibilities of political progress, a subject first raised in relation to Hippodamus's proposal to reward political novelties. It also involves the question of the relation of Lycurgus, the Spartan lawgiver, to Minos, the Cretan lawgiver, on the one hand, and to Thales, whose pupil Aristotle says he is reputed to have been. Minos, the son of Zeus and Europa, represents the oldest tradition of Greek law as it ascends to the gods. Thales is the traditional founder of philosophy. So the Cretan institution, which Aristotle praises most highly, is that of the common meals, which are paid for from the public lands and not a private means for securing moderation at table. Also, he has segregated the women from the men in order that they might not bear many children, and for the same purpose as has instituted homosexual relations among the men. Okay. The Cretan institution, which Aristotle praises most highly, is that of the common meals, which are paid for from the public lands and are not a private charge, as at Sparta. The legislator, he says, has devised many wise means for securing moderation at table. Also, he has segregated the women from the men in order that they might not bear many children, and for the same purpose has instituted homosexual relations among the men. It's interesting the word instituted homosexual relations. Yeah, there you go. The idea that in contemporary terms, people talk about sexual identity, and the word identity seems to imply it's fixed. Although, if you study this stuff and you pay attention to popular culture, it seems anything but fixed. It seems like it's fluctuating according to popularity, in co according to, might we say, what has been instituted, possibly. I don't know. It depends on. To check out the episode we did with Brenda Lebsack, who spent 30 plus years in public education in Orange County, including at the Board of Education. And, she is convinced that there's a policy of instituting homosexuality at the public schools. And that episode is called Manufacturing the Q's in LGBTQ, and as a matter of public policy in California. We covered last time on the podcast. Do you remember? Just last time, the policy of lying to parents so that they can encourage and manufacture cues. Even when it goes against the constitutional rights and the constitutional boundaries forbidding such thing, even when it violates constitutional rights of parents and goes beyond the constitutional powers of the government. It's very interesting. Thought I would just point that in there. Now, Harry continues here on Aristotle, bottom of page 91. Whether this is good or bad, says Aristotle, there will be another opportunity to inquire about instituting homosexuality and stuff like that. There is, however, no further discussion on this question of this question in any surviving text, and we may observe that this perverse institution does offer one solution to a recurring problem in the politics: how to keep the ratio of population to property constant. Now, this is all assuming like a top-down instituting, right, to solve problems like this. That's a big idea right there. Okay, I'll just throw that out there, something for you to chew on there. Okay. Now, another solution, of course, was immigration. Whether Crete is one of the three best governed actual regimes because of or in spite of this one feature remains speculative. The principal explicit criticism of Crete is that it does not have any constitutional means of reconciling the people to the regime, as at Sparta, where the people choose the ephors, so that disconnected members of the upper classes combine with the people periodically to make what are, in effect, revolutions. Page 92 at the top. The discussion of the Carthaginian regime follows the same pattern as that of Crete. First, some general remarks comparing it to the others. Second, the principal points of resemblance to Sparta. Third, criticism of the principal features of the regime. So this is now Carthage, famous, famous regime in ancient times, especially if you study the history of Rome and the conflicts that Rome, the alleged republic, had with Carthage, which is in North Africa. I'm going to take a drink of water here. Okay, so the most conspicuous feature of the general remarks is the praise of Carthage. Carthage comes closest to Sparta, which has already been praised as better than Crete. The three regimes, says Aristotle, come closer to each other than any of them do to any other regime, and all are greatly superior to any others. The proof of the excellence of Carthage is the fact that the demos, or common people, have remained faithful to it, and that neither civil strife nor tyranny worth mentioning has arisen there. Such remarks go quite beyond what Aristotle has said in praise of Sparta and justify classifying Carthage as the best of all actual regimes. Two further points ought to be made here, although they invite the interpretation of Aristotle's silence rather than his words. Carthage is a non-Greek, or in a technical sense, barbarian polis. And we are not given any information by Aristotle concerning the legislator or legislators of Carthage, or their relation, if any, to the famous legislators or teachers of legislators, concerning whom he says a great deal elsewhere in the Politics. The three points of resemblance to Sparta are the common messes of the companions, equivalent to the Phidytia, the office of the 104, equivalent to the Ephorate, and the kings and council of elders, which correspond to the kings and elders at Sparta. In this context, Aristotle mentions that the 104 are chosen for merit, not at random, as in Sparta, and the kings are chosen not from the same families, but from outstanding ones. As to political criticism, this falls into three categories: features common to Carthage and the other regimes, which Aristotle has sufficiently spoken of in the case of the other two, and those which depart from aristocracy, either toward democracy or toward oligarchy. The democratic deviation is the practice of referring to the popular assembly, not only for approval, but for discussion and for ultimate decision, any question upon which kings and elders cannot agree. The oligarchic deviation is in the manner of choosing the magistrates, which is based upon a kind of electoral college system comprised of boards of five, which are co-opted, and membership in which is clearly restricted to the wealthy classes, although Aristotle does not explicitly say so. Page 93 at the top. But the chief deviation from aristocracy is in an opinion rather than an institution, and it is one that is shared by the many as well as the few. For whatever the ruling class holds in honor, Aristotle says in a memorable phrase, the rest of the citizens are certain to follow. This opinion is that rulers should be chosen not only for their virtues, but for their wealth. The Carthaginians think that a poor man lacks the leisure for governing well, in which they are, of course, right, but the legislator errs, that is, ERRS, errs, in not providing from the outset that the best men have sufficient leisure, whether in or out of office. This leads us to certain observations concerning Aristotle's procedure with these three regimes. The very first question he took up vis-à-vis Sparta concerned the provision of leisure, which he said is not easy to provide. He there speaks of the difficulties that Spartans and Thessalians had with their servile classes, and no solution for the problem of leisure is hinted at, which does not require a servile class. The Cretans, we are told, have escaped this problem mainly because of the fortune of geography. The requirement of leisure is clearly correlated with the hypothesis or principle of the regime. And Sparta, we saw, was severely criticized for mistaking the nature of virtue. In the treatment of Crete, much is made of the advantages they enjoy from geography. As you guys know, Crete is an island in the Mediterranean. That's what he's referring to. They are evidently less warlike than the Spartans, but in this they are weak rather than wiser. Aristotle says remarkably little about the principle or hypothesis of the Cretan regime. With Carthage, he returns somewhat obliquely to the question of the principle of the regime. Carthage is the only regime of the three that he plainly calls aristocratic, although he does so only in pointing out how it deviates from aristocracy. But as Sparta confuses a part of virtue, courage or military valor, with the whole of virtue, so Carthage confuses a condition of virtue, leisure and wealth required for it, with virtue itself. I'm adding the word itself there. Harry continues here on bottom of page 93. In doing so, the legislator has made the whole polis avaricious. It is significant how the criticism of Sparta and Carthage, which Aristotle has already said are closest to each other, here coincides. The consequence of Spartans' devotion to war was also to cause a deviation mainly to oligarchy. Now, we now come to the last of the three main subdivisions of Book Two. This section, dealing with lawgivers, is frequently regarded as consisting of jottings or rough notes, either by Aristotle or a later hand. This view fails to consider, however, the way in which this section seems to fulfill a plan in Book Two. moving as it does from the theoretical to the practical to the practical theoretical, i.e., from those who took no part in politics but wrote on the best regime to good regimes of practice, to the views of those who hold, sorry, to the views of both. I got to start that sentence again. I'm sorry. I screwed that one up. Well, this is a long sentence. That's why I screwed it up. Okay, this view fails to consider. Which view are we talking about? We come now to the last of the three main subdivisions of Book Two. This section dealing with lawgivers is frequently regarded as consisting of jottings or rough notes, either by Aristotle or a later hand. This view fails to consider. Okay, so this view means the interpretation of what Aristotle is doing in this last section of Book Two. This view, however, in the way in which this section seemed to fulfill a plan, this view fails to consider, however, the way in which this section seems to fulfill a plan in Book Two. So Harry is saying, hold on a second, let's give Aristotle more credit here. If you just read it, it actually makes sense as well planned ending of Book Two. So this view fails to consider, however, the way in which this section seems to fulfill a plan in Book Two, moving as it does from the theoretical to the practical theoretical, from those who took no part in politics but wrote on the best regime to good regimes of practice, to the views of those who both held opinions concerning the best regime and took part in politics. Moreover, while there are three regimes of theory and three of practice, there are nine legislators mentioned by Aristotle. The central one of these is Onomacritus, whose name means name judge, and who was a Locrian who traveled in Crete, where he practiced soothsaying. According to tradition, a tradition in which Aristotle himself places little credence, he was the first man who became skillful in legislation, as Plato was first to introduce community of wives and children, Phaleus first to equalize property, Hippodamus first, not a politician, to speak of the best regime. Apparently, however, he did not have any pupils, but had as a companion Thales, who in turn had Lycurgus and Zaleucus for pupils. Okay. Now, the whole subject of the relation of tradition to the arts, as of Minos to Thales, and the nature of the relation of progress in the one to progress in the other is certainly involved here, as it is in the great thematic passage on Hippodamus, but only a comprehensive analysis of the admittedly episodic passages in this section and their relation to similar passages elsewhere in the Politics could establish their meaning. So that was a hermeneutical point that Harry just made, and he's saying that it probably hangs together better than that position that he was talking about gives it credit for. Now, we're on page 94, and there is a break in the text. We've been going for about 40 minutes, and the break in the text, which occurs here on page 94, I think is a convenient place for us to stop for today, because the very next sentence says Book Three begins as follows. So he gets into Book Three. And I'm not sure how much of this section I really want to get to today, starting book three. I think we've covered quite a bit just in terms of these three actual and theoretical considerations, actual regimes and theoretical considerations. Now, he's going to go through the whole book, right? And on page 105, he's still talking about book three. He doesn't start talking about book four until page 106. So that would be about a 12 page. Maybe we should go a little bit into book three just to make this a little bit easier to space out. I think I will continue just a little bit here. Book three begins as follows. To the one inquiring concerning the regime, what each is and of what sort, almost the first inquiry to make is about the polis, whatever is the polis. Aristotle says he must discover what and what sort each regime is. There is then a variety of regimes. We must try to understand what that variety is by again trying to understand what the polis is. But have we not already had the polis defined for us? Aristotle carefully says that almost the first question is, whatever is the polis? The first question was answered by the definition with which the politics began, a definition elaborated and defended in the remainder of Book One. The opening definition establishes the relation of the polis to other species of human community on the one hand, and to the genus communities of gregarious animals on the other. And in Book One, Aristotle established the definition of the polis as the community of communities, originating in the need to preserve life, but continuing for the sake of the self-sufficient or good life. The analysis of the household and the sciences arising from its needs establishes the necessity of a separate science of the polis, as it established the specific differences of polis and household. Book two demonstrated the need for a new inquiry into the best regime. Book three supplies us with the science of the polis and the leading feature of that science, an adequate inquiry into the principles of regimes, and in particular, of the best regime. Page 95 at the top. In Book One, Aristotle controverted two scientific or philosophical doctrines, those of Platonism and conventionalism, to establish the doctrine that the polis was a complex natural whole. In doing this, he pursues methods concerning which he makes two remarks near the beginning of Book One. It is his accustomed method, he says, to analyze a compound whole into its simplest uncompounded elements. What he actually does, however, as he indicates, is rather to trace the genesis of the compound whole from the genesis of the elements of which it is compounded. These two methods are not, of course, exclusive. Both speak of the whole and of parts, but one begins from the parts and discovery from the parts that they must be compounded into a larger whole to fulfill their function as parts. The other begins with the whole and discovers from the whole that it is resolved into parts whose functioning makes the whole. The parts discussed in Book One, however, are households or families. In Book Three, citizens. Aristotle's point of view in Book One is one of radical detachment from political life. He observes the polis as one among the number of forms of community which are the result of the gregarious nature of animals, and he wishes to classify it accurately in relation to the genera and subgenera of which it is a species. In Book Two, He dissects the various species specimen proposed. Excuse me. In book two, he dissects the various specimens proposed as possessing the perfections upon which the most accurate classification might be based. In book three, however, when he no longer treats of the opinions of others concerning the regime, but begins to present his own doctrine, he appears not as an external observer, but as someone within the polis. The conflicts of opinions with which we are immediately confronted are no longer the conflicts between observers of political life. They are conflicts among participants, among men who differ as to how the burdens and advantages of political life should be divided and shared. What is most significant about Aristotle's method in Book Three is not so much that it is analytical in the sense indicated, but that it draws philosophical conclusions from the opinions of men who are neither philosophers nor legislators, but men who are contending for political advantages in political life. I'm going to take a drink of water here. Well, I'm going to mute it for a sec. All right. Thanks for your impatience. The subdivisions of Book Three are not marked in the same manner as those of Book Two. This is Aristotle's exposition of his own doctrine and not the critique of the other regimes. And there is a continuity in the argument and a recurrence of themes which is not easy to anatomize. Some division of Book Three, however, provisional, is necessary for an orderly presentation. So, in other words, what Harry's saying is, I'm doing my best, guys. I'm gonna try to make this helpful for you. To begin with, he continues on bottom of page 95, Book Three may be divided by the transition from the answer to the opening question, whatever is the polis, to the question, is there one regime only or many? It is a matter of speculation whether we should consider the discussion of, going to page 96, monarchy as a third major subsection, or whether this continues and completes the discussion of regimes. The discussion of monarchy begins by recalling that it is one of the correct regimes, but the form of monarchy which emerges as the most important topic of discussion is, okay, we got a technical term here. Pombasalia. 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 I'm not sure exactly where the emphasis is, but I would have to get back into the CDs that we found in Pompeii. Well, actually, they were 8 tracks. Because they're so old. This is a kind of absolute rule in which the king is to the polis as the head of the household is to the household. It is thus called a kind of economic rule, but since economic rule is fundamentally different from political rule, according to the general doctrine of politics, it cannot be assumed that this fifth form of monarchy is a form of regime properly so called. Therefore, it is at least doubtful whether the discussion of monarchy, which culminates in the consideration of Pombasalia or absolute monarchy, Basileia is the word for king in Greek. Basileus, Basileia, I think. Basileus, maybe. Trying to remember, but yeah, it's okay. So absolute monarchy would be the prefix would be the absolute monarchy, which sounds like It sounds a little bit redundant, right? I mean, isn't the point of a monarchy that you are absolute? I don't know. But anyway, basileus, I think, is the Greek word for king. It's been a while. I have to check it out, which culminates in the consideration of pon basale or absolute monarchy, forms part of the discussion of regime, or is a third major subsection of Book Three. Now he goes into the first subsection, which may be conveniently, though not perhaps not definitively, divided into three subsections. First, the definition of the citizen, politeis, and therewith the polis. Second, the inquiry as to who is a citizen and what makes the polis the same or different when the regime changes because of the revolution. Third, the first of the great disputations of Book Three. Is the virtue of a good man and a good citizen the same or different? The definition of the citizen is required because it is a matter of dispute what the polis is. Some say that an action is an action of the polis, others that it is an action not of the polis, but of the oligarchy or tyrant. Who are they who thus deny that an action is that of the polis, and what is that action? In considering the problem of revolution, Aristotle makes explicit what is implicit at the beginning of Book Three. When the regime changes from oligarchy or tyranny to democracy, the people may repudiate the public debt on the ground that the money was borrowed not by the polis, but by the oligarchic clique or the tyrant. Hence, the denial is a democratic denial of a financial obligation, and the action is the one of incurring debt. It is well to remember this when we discover that the first or absolute definition of citizenship applies more particularly to democracies than to other forms. There's a lot in that paragraph there. There's a lot there, buddy. It's very interesting. Very interesting. Let me go back to. Let's reread part of it and think about it again. The definition of the citizen is required because it is a matter of dispute what the polis is. Some say that an action is an action of the polis, others that it is an action not of the polis, but of the oligarchy or tyrant. Who are they who thus deny that an action is that of the polis, and what is that action? In considering the problem of revolution, Aristotle makes explicit what is implicit at the beginning of Book Three. When the regime changes from oligarchy or tyranny to democracy, the people may repudiate the public debt on the ground that the money was borrowed not by the polis, but by the oligarchic clique or the tyrant. Hence, the denial is a democratic denial of a financial obligation, and the action is one of incurring debt. It is well to remember this when we discover that the first or absolute definition of citizenship applies more particularly to democracies than to other forms. This is an interesting question because, I mean, in corporate law and administrative law, it's a very similar issue. There was a lawsuit. This is going to sound totally off the mark here. There was a lawsuit 2 years ago. I can't remember. I think it was settled last year. Might have been 2 years ago. Vineyard and Anaheim. And if you look it up, you'll see that the resolution of this case depended in large measure upon who were considered members and per se versus associate members. And it's a very interesting similarity with what you might wonder about with regime change in Iran right now. The question is parts versus whole. How do you tell when the whole is acting, when the actions of the whole are undertaken by parts? Well, I don't want to beg the question, but are undertaken by individuals, you know? And you know, he's using the word tyrant, but that's just a word for an individual, or oligarchy, which would be a word for families or cliques that would inevitably have individuals at the head of those cliques making decisions as if on behalf of the organization or the regime. So, for example, in the Vineyard case, there was, I mean, this was like a lot of money. I think it was tens of millions of dollars. I don't know where they get all this money. Jeez. We have a really tiny church. And I can't even imagine having that kind of a budget, but you can imagine why there would be such a dispute about the who's calling the shots for that money and where the money is going and how to control it. You can't have responsibility without control, right? And it's pretty basic. That's really basic human decency. You don't hold somebody responsible if they don't control. And so it's really responsibility has to do with power and duty. They both have to be there. Power and duty. You see the same thing with the President of the United States. The president takes himself to have the power and the duty, that is the responsibility, to act on behalf of the United States in foreign affairs. And to protect the United States from threats that may not be well understood by the average person on the street. Now, in terms of Iran and the regime change here, it is interesting. I mean, let's say there is a regime change, and the movement is to more democratic accountability in line with the principles of the American founding, maybe. Well, could they just cancel debts? That's kind of what he's saying is you could make the argument that the tyrants or the oligarchy was the ones that in their private capacity took on those debts, and they're not to be saddled with those debts because they were not acting on behalf of the regime itself, but they had an improper they were somehow improperly taking on debts, I guess. Anyway, it's very similar with corporate law, nonprofit corporate law. I think it's just a general issue of responsibility. Who are the members? And in the case of regimes, who are the citizens? And so the Republicans are holding to this, they're holding firm, we are holding firm to the idea that citizenship has to be cherished, it has to be well defined. And those two things seem to be in conflict in some ways with birthright citizenship. Birthright of citizenship definitely seems like it's clear in terms of sufficient condition for citizenship, but because it's so easy to achieve that, it seems to undermine taking citizenship itself seriously as a normative role, rather than just, for example, something like a PIN code on an ATM card where you just take money out and all you have to do is know the PIN code. All you have to do is know, all you have to do is produce a birth certificate. So there's a fight on about that right now, and be interesting to see what happens there. I'm not sure how much I want to say about that here in this context. But the issue of citizenship is very important. It's very important because what you're doing is you're defining essentially the board of directors, like in a corporation. And you want the best board in there possible, but how do you get to be a board member? Is essentially because ultimately you're the one calling the shots, right? So if you have a bunch of foreign families coming in and anchor babying and then heading out and going to a different regime, and they're really in their hearts citizens of a different regime, they're not really Americans in their hearts, but they're technically, it's almost like you swiped an ATM card and then you know the PIN number and all you're doing is taking money out. But it could be worse than that because if this is happening on a large scale, this could be a development that benefits a foreign power at the expense of the United States. And it all has to do with who is in charge here, who's calling the shots. And, I mean, what else is new? This is the gift that keeps on giving, as Michael Uhlman used to say. Let's go a little bit further and we're going to stop here. Bottom page 96. The absolute or unqualified definition of citizenship is that it is nothing other than a sharing in the administration of justice and in office. This means participating in what we would call legislation and adjudication, with these two powers being sufficiently broad to assimilate what we would understand by administration or execution of the laws. Indeed, Aristotle generalizes from this first definition, saying that what he really means is participation in indefinite office. This definition, he then observes, fits democracy particularly well, but not necessarily other regimes. The idea of indefinite office fits democracy because there are all free men constitute a body. Excuse me. The idea of indefinite office fits democracy because all free men constitute a body from whom office holders are drawn. And nearly all free men participate in some offices, particularly those of jurymen, that's people on a jury, who had a wide variety of functions in ancient democracy beyond those we assign to jurymen. But such a definition does not fit regimes such as Sparta or Carthage, where political participation is narrowly limited and defined. That is, where few people hold any offices and only some people can hold some offices. Nevertheless, the definition holds if we say that citizenship means participation in the deliberative and judicial functions of the polis, and that he is a citizen who can and does so participate. And finally, a polis is a collection of citizens, numerous enough to lead a self-sufficient life. All right, we're going to end part five up there of Harry Jaffa's take on this wonderful text, Aristotle's Politics, published originally as just called Aristotle in this volume, History of Political Philosophy, edited by Joseph Cropsey and Leo Strauss, published by Rand McNally in 1963. Later editions were published by the University of Chicago Press, but are missing this selection from Harry Jaffa. Harry Jaffa was my intellectual grandfather because he mentored those who mentored me, including Michael Uhlman, probably the most significant mentor I had, although I had several in politics, the late Michael Uhlman, and who was trained by Harry. And we miss him greatly. So there's a personal connection here. And then, of course, I've mentioned the connection that Harry Jaffa had with Barry Goldwater in 1964 and the development of the Republican Party in the post-New Deal era, reacting to what Democrats did during the Great Depression. And it's a very interesting time to study this stuff. I'm looking forward to the next selection that we have in Christopher Caldwell's wonderful book called The Age of Entitlement, because it's called War. It's on war, and it's considering the Vietnam War. Wow. Yeah. We're going to get to that coming up. And I'm also going to start a new series on the presidency. We're going to go through Charles Thatch's doctoral dissertation, which was reissued by Liberty Fund Press. It's called The Creation of the Presidency. And I think it's a small book, but it's going to give you a flavor for understanding where the institution of the office of the presidency comes from. So we'll take a look at that. Thanks for joining me on the Republican Professor podcast. I've been your host, Dr. Lucas J. Mather. We've been interacting with ancient political philosophy through the lens of my intellectual grandfather, Harry Jaffa, who was also a trainer of people like Barry Goldwater. And we're very interested in both the practical and the theoretical here, the philosophical, as well as the theological. And thank you for joining me. I hope it was interesting. It was 10, it today is 10 April, 2026 years after Jesus. It's a Friday. Take care. God bless you guys. See you next time.